what we're hearing in this piece of music is a very famous song called A Whiter Shade of Pale by a 1960s pop band called Procol Harum, probably best known for its distinctive organ introduction. It's an interesting story. The main songwriter, Gary Brooker, the main composer, didn't have that part in his original composition. So it was added later during the recording process, during rehearsals between the musicians who eventually formed the band. And the organist, Matthew Fisher, improvised the organ part over the chords that Gary Brooker had written for the song. We have an example of a very clear distinction between the composer of the frame of the song, which is the chords, and the musician who then created an instrumental part that is very famous and also part of the eventual recorded song. Well, the song was a huge hit. It was a number one hit in the 1960s in the United Kingdom. It was successful all over the world, and its popularity continues today. It's heard on countless advertisements in films and television programs. It still generates a huge amount of revenue, which is one of the reasons why 40 years after the song was recorded, the court case eventually came up.
With royalties from the song running into hundreds of thousands of pounds, the question of how much of that money, if any, should go to organist Matthew Fisher went before a judge in 2006. Would the law recognise Fisher as a joint author of Whiter Shade of Pale?
What the law requires is that there has to be a joint undertaking by both parties to create a single work. So what the court had to decide was whether there was such an undertaking to create this work, and that what Matthew Fisher had done in contributing the organ part was original enough in the copyright sense for it to be protected. And in the High Court, the judge was very clear that when you have such a recognisable contribution, the organ part of the song A Whiter Shade of Pale is probably the most famous thing about the song. In such a case, the court was satisfied that this was certainly original enough for the purposes of copyright.
In the event, the case went all the way to the House of Lords. The decision was that Fisher would, in future, be entitled to a share of the song's royalties. Crucially, the courts drew a distinction between the song, the written composition, and the arrangement, the version actually recorded and featuring Matthew Fisher's distinctive organ.
So the court was satisfied, and the Court of Appeal made this very clear, that Matthew Fisher was a joint author of the arrangement in the case. So both the composition and the arrangement are musical works under copyright, but they can be different works, and they can be different sounding works.
Procol Harum aren't the only band to have become embroiled in legal action. Copyright cases have also flared up over songs by Pink Floyd and Spandau Ballet, for example. Away from the world of pop, though, musicians can have a more relaxed view of copyright. Dr. McDonough, a fellow in LSE's Department of Law, has researched how things work in the field of Irish traditional music.
Even though musicians are somewhat aware of copyright, and they're not anti-copyright in any way, they are wary of it because there's a traditional share ethic amongst Irish traditional musicians. That's the way the music has been created over time. That's the way the music has been passed down from one generation to the next. That's the way that all musicians learn music, is through sharing tunes and playing each other's different versions of tunes. The authors, the composers and the arrangers in the world of Irish traditional music are relatively relaxed about this, because the number one thing that they want is for their music to be accepted as part of the tradition. So there's less emphasis on collecting license fees and royalties.
And different models of copyright exist in other creative industries, among computer software programmers, for example.
In any area where you have collaborative creativity, you're going to find that the ordinary rules of copyright don't work as well as they do when you have a single author doing his bit and creating a single work. Creative people find ways of taking a step back from copyright and allowing the freedom to create, to bloom. So, for example, in the world of Irish traditional music, musicians tend to take a step back from copyright to share tunes and compositions and arrangements in an informal way. Whereas in the field of open source software, you have software programmers who actually formally license their creations. They're aware that they own the copyrights and sometimes the patents to what they're doing, but they're just choosing to license it on an open basis, which means, in a general sense, that any programmer can come along and improve the software and pass it down the line to other programmers.
Now, Luke McDonough is extending his research into the world of theatre, interviewing writers, directors and actors to see who, in their view, should own a work of drama.
The creativity that goes on in theatre is impossible without collaboration. And copyright tends to reward the writer, the playwright, with the authorship of the dramatic work, which is the play. And I wanted to investigate whether that is the correct way of giving authorship in the context of drama.
So, with the law ready to protect an author's rights, how do you stop a joint creative career ending in acrimony years or even decades later?
The way to avoid these kind of legal difficulties is to put your relationship to your other creative partners in writing. And that was something that the High Court emphasized very strongly in Fisher and Brooker, that any young bands out there should make sure that they put their relationship to each other in writing. So it is a slightly boring thing to say, but it can prevent these kinds of difficulties cropping up decades later, as you have in the case of Fisher and Brooker.